So I figured out that at some point there has to be some set of algorithms or some way to use those data to help the person with diabetes make a better decision. Not when you meet your doctor and the doctor will, you know, take a look into your historical data, but every day, every hour when you want to make a decision.
Well, can I pronounce your name as Shami?
Yeah, exactly. So this is, you know, this is something I had to come up to ease the pronunciation of my real name.
I would actually want to learn that. Could you?
Yeah. So it sounds so. In Poland, we have a couple of names have their like softer versions. So my name can go. Or the long and very serious Przemysław, but it can go also longer shorter version Przemek, yeah, which is kind of sound like a Shemi.
Okay, Przemek.
Yeah, exactly. And actually one of the companies we have worked in the past, founder was calling me like that, and I decided I will take over this idea.
yeah, but Przemek, I would say, is not difficult to pronounce if you ask me. Yeah, I can say Przemek. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. For me. Yeah. For you, for you, and I've noticed that for some people it's easier, but for gross number of people from abroad, it wasn't uneasy to pronounce, and to clear the confusions was better too.
So I have a ridiculously long name. It's called Prathamesh, and since I was in first grade, all my teachers have been playing with my name since I was like a very small child. So I'm used to Prathamesh, 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 Pratham. So I literally tell people that, whatever you call me from the bottom of your heart, I will openly accept it. It's completely
exactly,
okay.
Exactly. So I was my case was only to stick to the one, in online world, because, we need to take care of that.
Could you briefly tell me what that name means? Like, does it stand for something from a cultural perspective?
So I was trying to look for that some time ago, because in our culture it's not very, it's not like in some cultures you have that this name in translation means, and this kind of things are very embraced. In our culture we don't have it, but some names have their meanings, and as far as I remember, and also you can find different interpretations, obviously. In my case was, on one hand, somebody that is thoughtful, think about things through. Another interpretation was somebody that is from the industry sector, because Przemysł in Polish means industry. So different, already two different interpretations.
Well, if you go with the first one, which is thoughtful, it kind of fits you, because you work in AI, which is to kind of make machines how to think.
Yeah.
So, well, Przemek, first of all, I deeply appreciate that, you're spending the time to talk to me. I've been waiting to have this conversation, because unlike me, you are, very well aware and educated on the subject of AI. And even yesterday, I was interviewing a person from IBM Research, who also was in the AI department in IBM. And, I asked him a lot of questions about general intelligence. And, a lot of companies are trying to solve that AI problem. And I was also trying to learn more and more about what D-Labs is doing and about diabetes lab in particular?
I must say that AI is at the moment when I started was even easier to, you know, grasp, because I had an impression many years ago when I was starting that, you know, this industry is just starting. And now I spent majority of my day reading about the different things, and I still don't feel I'm up to speed with everything what's going on. So I think there are a lot of people that are, you know, so deep in the particular applications or the particular fields of AI that knows much, much more than I do. So it's one of the challenges I have, to be honest, how to
keep up to date.
Exactly.
So, you know, before we begin discussing D-Labs, I was actually curious how you understood AI for the first time. Was it something that you always wanted to do with your life? Like, for example, you know, in the early college days, right? Is that your idea? Okay, I'm going to grow up and teach myself computer science and, you know, do something, a business or a job in AI? Or was it something that, you know, you kind of ended up doing by accident?
I think it was maybe not by total accident, but I have this attribute that I like many different subjects, and I was thinking about the many different, you know, possible future works I can do when I grow up. And yes, because I was raised on the, you know, sci-fi movies and all that things, so obviously, you know, AI field was one of the fields I was feeling connected somehow, you know, that I probably can find myself in that sector in the future. But it took a different, you know, different routes to that, but for sure I was always somehow connected to computers, and I was from the, you know, from early in my days, early, I mean, when I was young, I was fascinated about the, you know, internet, computers, development, software development, games industry, and a lot of things going on.
Did you have a computer growing up, or yeah. Did you? Okay.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was something that was very hard to pursue, you know, to ask my parents for that, and especially mother, it was hard to, you know, convince her that this is something that can pay off in the future.
Yeah, and in the old days, right, they were also very expensive, like they were not as cheap as they are today.
Of course, it was like you were dreaming about having a CD station, an example that can, you know, when they were coming.
Were your parents like already working in computer when you were growing up, or they do
my
something
father,
different?
My father is, so both were scientists. So my mother was an archaeologist, and my father was when he was, you know, doing his studies, there was no computer science as a field. So his background was chemistry, but still on his, you know, when he was studying, he, you know, get to the, you know, numerical methods and, you know, the soft, well, I don't know if you can call it software development at that time, but, you know, to the concept of programming machines. So he was, when I was growing, he was very, you know, very much well-established computer scientist. After many, many years of, you know, of doing, you know, numerical calculations for big tiring company.
Yeah.
On the very early computers. So for my father, yes. My mother, no.
So, you know, you grew up with parents who were scientists. So were a lot of, you know, like dinner discussions around subjects of science and chemistry? In a sense, was it like a very normal thing? Yeah.
So the fact is that my parents divorced very early on my when I was, I don't know, maybe 6, 7. I don't remember exactly. So they divorced anyway. So I don't remember if they were discussing a lot, but I do remember that my mother, from my mother's side, that passed away also years back, and I remember she was constantly discussing or talking about some sort of science from her field. So I would say that probably yes, or at least I had some early touch with their subjects, but later on, due to life events, I had to discover my own path, I would say.
Do you feel that like a lot of times how your parents talk around you and the kind of ideas they share with you, it really influences us when we are growing up? Do you feel like they were able to give you like a curiosity that you are still pursuing in your life?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I don't know if you have kids. I don't have yet. So,
no, I don't have kids.
You don't. All right. All right. But I think, at least from the theory that it is kind of obvious that, the brain of a child is like sucking everything from the external world. And this is how it is shaped later on. Yeah. So I agree totally. Mm-hmm.
Let's reach we're discussing childhood. So how was college like?
Yeah. College. So I was already very much into computer science, but at that time I was fascinated. As far as I remember, I was fascinated very much about hacking, network administration, all the Linux stuff that was at that time also something, the open source as a movement, also something that is
growing. It was just getting started.
Yeah. So I was fascinated about all that concept. I didn't like much, the mainstream operating systems at that time. I was not even aware that there is company called Apple. I didn't even, was aware early on that time about where they are going, or maybe nobody knew at that time. I was fascinated about all that things going on, but more from the rebel type, meaning that I was very interested into hackers groups, etc., and how to get into some system, how everything is built, how all that things works, and how you discover even the ways to get into the system. Obviously, I was inspired by, again, probably movies and books.
Yeah. If you are saying that Apple computers was not very well known, right? Was AI as a field of study popular at the time?
No, I think it was the first more practical practical approach, I think, was I discovered during my studies, but at that time, there was no internet, was also in the the very early stages, so might happen that if I will try to look for some books, obviously AI was, or some kind of machine learning algorithms were already developed in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken by my memory. So for sure some grounds were laid already in those days. But I think also what changed a lot was first internet, and also how fast the computing power developed. So no, at that time, no practical discoveries on my side, but I believe probably somebody somewhere was already thinking about that.
And did you start working with, I believe, CERN, CERN, right after college?
Yes. No. I was there actually at the later part of my physics studies, and yeah. So it was much later.
How was it like? Like, did you find what you were looking for before trying to work there?
Very good question. Actually, somebody already asked me today also from my colleagues, and you know, it can unfold into two ways. One way was I was very inspired by the again movies, and I had some kind of the picture in my head by the movies. There was even at that time there was a movie Da Vinci Code, and with Tom Hanks, I believe. There was a lot of things connected to CERN, and of course I knew that a lot of things there in the movie are just fantasy. Yeah, exactly. It's just a fiction. But I was believing until my day of arrival there that it is really technologically advanced, that you're going into almost a spaceship when you are getting into work every day. So on that part, when I arrived there, I was surprised because it was except control rooms for accelerators and detectors, and for the people in, like, let's say normal people working on the on the more normal tasks. It was normal university campus without any fancy fancy equipment, etc. So on that it was that on but of course I was very satisfied anyway, because first of all many years before I was dreaming about going there, maybe working at that place. Because it was just fascinating how mankind, what the mankind is capable of building and doing. So obviously it was a great, great time, and it gave me really acceleration in my personal growth, I would say. Because I was, first of all, I was learning a lot there, and I was on the deep water in a way, because I was also I faced how much I still need to learn to keep up with everything. So it was really fascinating time, and I think it was, I have a couple of things in my life that I believe somehow, pushed me to the place where I am, and were kind of, milestones. So this might be a proper word. And for sure being there was one of those milestones, to learn from the smart people there, meet new people, have new connections, and have a very interesting job.
The kind of things I was thinking about CERN in particular is how does an organization like CERN decide what are the problems that are worth investigating? In the sense, once a scientific problem is identified, there is a huge investment of human resource and capital resource and just a lot of other kinds of resources. So could you maybe share some insight as to how they, select the problems?
I'm quite sure I'm not the proper person to answer this question, but I can give you some feelings I have, and probably because also when I was there, I was, during my studies, so I was very young and early in my career. Although I was working before going there, I was already working as a software development for other companies. I believe that how I understand how this works, not only at CERN but many different research facilities, grants funding, research funding in general, is that first of all, probably there is a lot of political involvement, meaning not the political per se, but there are probably people that are trying to push for their research, etc. I also know that this organization is an organization that many countries are paying paying for for the shares for keeping it, and thanks to that, and because some country, let's say, that is paying some percentage of the budget for this year budget of this organization, in exchange of that, as far as I know, and I think it's true, this organization have to keep like some percent, some percentage of money spent for the or the hiring people from that country or taking students from that country, etc., etc. So this is just, in my opinion, the tip of the iceberg. And if that's if that's how it works, on this kind of case, then probably in terms of research, there are much more I think we can call it political, let's say, involvement. But I'm not 100% sure how it works, and probably it's not very simple because there is a review processes, etc. So yeah.
While you were there, right, what were the kind of problems you worked on?
So I had like two things on the plate, I would say. One thing was, at that time I joined a division that was part of the bigger project, and they were, in general, the project, they were thinking about building the other way around. There was a consideration of, in 2025, and take into the account that when I was there, it was 2000, I think it was 2009, maybe. So at least 10 years ago, I should check the when was that. So CERN was considering building a new type of linear collider along with the detector, and the aim of that was to collide two particles, electron positon, and because of the different physics phenomenon, let's say, was that it has to be linear. And they were running, they have been thinking about building in 2025. So the project was already started, 20 years or 15 years before actual, date. And, to understand what should be built, all the parameters, there were many, many, many groups working on that project. And those groups had, each groups have had different objectives, and I was working in the group that had an objective to simulate the behavior of the one of the detectors there, and what kind of layers in those detectors, what kind of sub detectors should be implemented there to get closer to the confirmation of the of some physics going on when you collide those two particles. And of course I'm now trying to recall a lot of things from from my mind, from my memory, and it was some time ago. So this was, this was one of my I was driving at that simulation, took very essential part of that work, and one of my responsibilities to figure out, build and adapt mainly the system from other groups working at CERN to to run simulations on the grid, meaning that to run simulations on the different computers spread over the internet, over the world, that wanted to take part in the research. And the second part of my job was to develop using some frameworks that have been used at CERN, develop some subset of many algorithms to detect particular types of elementary particles, to understand better again how the detector will behave when this kind of particle will show.
I've been reading quite a lot on AI, and very recently DeepMind has been, I'm not sure if they have successfully developed a system, but they have been working on something called plasma control using AI, where in nuclear fusion, whenever nuclear fusion happens, that creates plasma, and to make sure that plasma does not touch the wall of the equipment, you have to control the plasma using electromagnetic walls, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the experiment is so fast that in traditional conventional systems, it's very difficult to figure out how to create the electromagnetic walls fast enough. In the sense, it's not possible to control the coils that create electromagnetic walls with the emission of the plasma. So what DeepMind is proposing is that they can build an AI engine that can predict where the plasma is going to go or in what direction it's going to go. And using that prediction, they will be able to figure out how to most efficiently create the electromagnetic walls by controlling the voltage in the coils. Like, this is something they are currently working on, which is an AI problem.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read this, right, I'm not the right person to even talk about this, but could you maybe share some insight as to what this all means?
Good question. Would be, of course, better to read the article first, because I'm not sure I'm up to this is the problem I mentioned in the beginning. There are so many things going on, so to give more insights or opinion about that, first of all, I would need to go deeper into the things you read and understand better what they are trying to do. But based on what you are saying, I think this is this might be solvable by AI. But yeah, I was looking at what they are doing, on the early stages of this research group, because of the famous Jeopardy game. Yeah. No, sorry, it was not
AlphaGo.
No, AlphaGo, yeah. So, yeah, I think it's probably one of the interesting subjects that AI might help a lot, and probably I'm quite sure at CERN at that time they already also doing a lot of things and a lot of experiments with the use of AI and machine learning in particular.
I was also reading about Diabetes Lab. And this is the one thing I'm always very curious about, is you had mentioned in the message you sent us that while working at CERN, you were thinking about Diabetes Lab, right? So you studied physics, and then you were also very interested in computer science. So how did Diabetes Lab came about? Like how
this is a story that is not is don't have an ending yet. I would say I have diabetes for over 25 years, so this was the main motivation behind that, but to, you know, to get you know, to get to the beginning of the story. So one of the things that like constantly was around me was this condition I have, and with this condition, at some point I saw the that, you know, I'm probably having some kind of machine or algorithm that can, you know, help me react faster, or help me understand what kind of, you know, patterns, what kind of, what generally, you know, what kind of decisions I can change, what kind of behavior I can change to get a better life, to get a better glucose. Because this is a very much, you know, data connected. Of course, you have a lot of devices now, insulin pumps, you know, continuous glucose monitoring devices that are helping you monitor your glucose level. But at the end, again, anyway, you have to take some actions. You have to make some decisions based on, first of all, what you eat, what type of activity you're planning to do, because in general, physical activity is helpful for diabetes. On the other hand, nobody knows how to quantify physical activity in regards to diabetes. Nobody knows how to exactly, you know, quantify the physical activity, and everybody is, you know, agreeing on the fact that physical activity is helpful because it helps you lower your glucose levels. So you have to take into account, you know, into the decisions you make also that. And another thing is what kind of glucose level you had in the past. What are you planning to eat, etc., etc. So in general, you have a lot of parameters that affects your life and your glucose level, and you have to somehow take into the calculation, you have to factor those in. And this is a typical, you know, typical data problem. So at CERN, when I was working at CERN, I was also, you know, working with algorithms, with you know, new tools in computer science I was not aware that exists. And at some point, the big data, this name appeared somewhere in the internet verse, let's say. So I figured out that at some point there has to be some set of algorithms or some way to use those data to help the person with diabetes make a better decision. Not when you meet your doctor and the doctor will, you know, take a look into your historical data, but every day, every hour when you want to make a decision. And of course, there are edge cases. In example, maybe I didn't plan to go for a run in the evening today, but maybe now I won't, and now I have to adjust my treatment to this plan, and it would be great to have some support in that. And you have, you know, those devices I mentioned at the beginning, they are getting better and better. There are already a lot of features in that devices, but still, you know, missing the some kind of, you know, recommender system that can help you make those decisions that will affect your next hours, days, and months and years of life. Because if you don't have this condition kept under control, of course you can have a very serious complications at some point. And you know, the interesting aspect of that is also that the this is, you know, very far in time from the moment. So if you are making a bad decision today, the consequence can come in a years later if this kind of, you know, bad actions, bad behaviors accumulate over time.
Could you share how did the initial phase of diabetes lab look like?
After CERN, I spent some time working on for other companies, other startups, etc. And at some point, I decided, okay, I think it's time to you know, start own business. And I have this idea. Let's try to do it. Long story short, I get an access to some acceleration program. That was in Italy at that time. We have started building the prototype there, and the concept was, you know, building algorithm that can gather your health related data as a person with diabetes, and based on those data serve you life-improving suggestions to help you keep your glucose stable during a different, you know, aspects of your life. And the sport, you know, sport activity was one of our top first use cases that we wanted to solve, because many people with diabetes are interested in physical activity. Some of them are interesting very a lot, like I am. So there's assumption was that they need some kind of a solution that will help them, you know, keep everything under the control. And those algorithms, of course, with the use of machine learning, was supposed to be interfaced to the mobile application. So this was the basic idea of what we wanted to build. And we started prototyping. We started, you know, we had some initial traction, meaning that we had users interested in that. We won this acceleration program, so we acquired some initial funding. We won a couple of prizes. We got some additional, you know, public funding, etc. But at some point, we struggled with the two things, and one thing was founding. So we were trying to look for the private investor, etc. Typical startup way. And second challenge was that was connected very much, that was to not getting funded by some VC. What is the perfect business model behind that kind of solution? Because we constantly had a customer patient in mind, what we want to build, but at some point you need to, you know, show the revenues, show that you will earn on that idea. And we failed on that. So this was one of my biggest learnings in life, that this kind of thinking needs to also be taken into account. And during that experimentation with the, you know, different prototypes, trying to find funding, etc., we get to the moment that we couldn't, you know, that we were so much in personal debt that we, meaning me and my co-founder, we decided, okay, we cannot, you know,
keep on doing this.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it was at that time we have been in States, somewhere at Stanford, I think, some kind of conference, and we have been like thinking, okay, we are building anyway a team of people that knows machine learning and are experts in artificial intelligence. So why not to try and, you know, earn money on consulting for other companies? And this is how this, you know, this started. And at that time, we thought it's, you know, it's a proper decision to make, because we have started earning some money, we had started having some B2B customers, etc., and decided to pursue this path.
You know, when you are working with healthcare data, is it a very heavily regulated space?
Yeah. Yeah, and that was another challenge we have had, was that we at some point we developed a model based on the data, that mainly on my data and the data volunteered to us by friends, family, and the people that were, you know, more closer to us. And those initial model, even that was not on the, you know, on the was not on the, you know, that we didn't have, you know, a lot of data. So you can imagine that, you know, you're building models mainly on the, you know, on the lot of data, and the data is, quality of the data is very important. And even we didn't have, you know, data from many, many, many patients, my smart team was able to develop the algorithm that at that time was able to predict based on a couple of different data dimensions, was able to predict glucose level for 1 hour ahead, based on different informations. And at that time, when we have checked more in details, the performance of the model, we figured out that we were at the, you know, the state of the art, so to say. So we seen in the papers that this kind of prediction is very high. On the other hand, we knew that we cannot implement this in the mobile app and give it to the users, because it is so highly regulated that it's hard to, you know, just throw the algorithm, because, you know, many things can go wrong, and this is like a chicken and an egg problem. So on the one hand you have a algorithm working, but you have to test it in the clinical trials. You have to, you know, do a lot of things that are very, you know, investment
expensive.
Exactly, that are expensive. And this was another challenge we wanted to solve, and we have tried a couple of times, you know, to get public funding again in my country to fund that. Which in definition is not easy as well. And this was another challenge. So we decided just to put some closure on that. So we decided at that time that we need to keep, you know, separate. So we have had, you know, the algorithm that was running, you know, that was not running, you know, on the public application, but just somewhere, you know, on the servers we have been testing that, and we have had at that time also a mobile application that acquired users, and the users were coming in, etc., but the application from our point of view was not giving any big value to the user, because we couldn't connect that algorithm. And for a long time we have been trying to solve this and also failed.
is it a technical problem or a compliance problem?
Compliance problem.
Or it's both? Yeah. It's a compliance problem.
At that time, it was a compliance problem, because if you want to give something to the users, of course, I could test it on myself, but if you want to give something like that to the users, you need to be sure that it works in the different, you know, condition, edge cases, etc., and, you know, because you can give some recommendation to the user, and the user will take medical action based on that. You know, the worst case scenario is that you can harm user, patient by accident. Yeah. So it was compliance problem, And to, you know, to overcome this compliance problem, you need to get a certification. To get the certification, you need to run clinical trials, etc., etc. So
when you say recommendation, right? From what I understand, the recommendations are mostly like go for a walk, exercise, or they were more, or are the recommendations more specific? Like, okay, take this medicine or something like that.
So we, from the beginning, we have been thinking about more specific use cases. In example, so I think I have somewhere I have still screenshots from the systems. We get into the even into the moment that we have been able to predict how much or how less the patient should take an insulin dosage. Meaning that we have been always trying to solve the holy grail of, you know, software for them, for people with diabetes, to, you know, give them, you know, really helpful advice, because you have a lot of nice fancy applications on the App Store and the other, you know, application stores, but they are not giving you exact things you can do. They are giving you general recommendations. And this is something, as a user, I'm saying now, something I miss a lot, because I think the data are there, the algorithms are there, the computing power is there. But I think the, you know, we still don't have the, you know, the features I would expect in the 21st century. You see what NASA is doing, you see what, you know, SpaceX is doing. So, I mean, there are a lot of you know, things that in the sense of science we already there, but somehow we still don't see it. You know, we can have a very high resolution of a photo from Mars. Wow, even more. Some years ago we have been able to, you know, to create a picture of the black hole, which is not a picture because it's based on, you know, it's based on data, and thanks, and all of that thanks to using AI. And still we don't have this kind of things, you know, in the applications. We have personal assistants like, you know, Siri, like Amazon Alexa, but this is a toy still. So I would expect that, you know, we have something that can help me be healthier.
Like, we solve these kind of problems first. From what you mentioned, right? So, okay, I do understand from a compliance perspective, you cannot give everything away in an application. But maybe, can the algorithm be used in a more clinical setting?
Yes, it could be, but still you need, you know, so in general, healthcare, health tech related, you know, solutions and businesses and startups are very capital. They need a lot of capital upfront. So before you will see, you know, return on investment, you need a lot of capital to get things running. And this is the main challenge I believe health tech startups have. So, and at least from, you know, from what I know. So, again, you need to, before even getting into, you know, a more clinical setting, you still need, you know, get a certification, get some, you know, trials, controlled trials on that, etc., etc. And at that time, because now there are a lot of new technological solutions, and they are, you know, they are coming every day. But at that time, still, we needed, you know, capital even to, you know, start getting, you know, some traction in terms of B2B segment. Yeah, what I'm saying is that we reached a limit of, you know, of what we can do without, you know, where we, without any additional external funding. So there are a lot of learnings from, you know, from that time that I could share for next hours even. But the main point is that the main point is that we decided at that time to, you know, to focus more on the software development business, being a consultant in the AI space, and to, you know, to earn money for, you know, being in the position that we can found found this by ourselves. And this was another, you know, important lessons, because we have been over optimistic how, you know, how easy it is to run a software company.
What you are mentioning, right, is I was just trying to remember where I heard exactly what you are saying. I just remembered that the founder of DeepMind, Demis,
mm-hmm.
he was on a podcast. I forgot what podcast. But, you know, DeepMind does not really make any product that makes money.
Yes, I'm aware of that. Yeah, I remember this fact as well. So, yeah, I'm aware of the, you know, of deep tech startups that the main purpose of existence is that they are building some kind of deep technology thanks to, you know, some you know, some smart people founded the company or you know, and inventing, you know, technology. And it's interesting concept, and on the other hand, I think it's also very challenging. It must be a very challenging path to you know, to convince, you know, because you need capital anyway. So probably they rely heavily on the, you know, external funding. So that is also a nice challenge, and I know that they have solved that.
So, you know, the story that Demis, the founder of DeepMind, that he was sharing on a podcast, right? He was exactly asked a question: how do you raise funding, or how do you keep going? Like, how do you pay the bills, right? And they are based out of, I think, UK. And he shared a story where he's like, you know, I was not able to find any VC who would be ready to put so much money on the line, and maybe for nothing. Like, if you're not able to build anything, then the whole money is gonna go to waste. So he mentioned that, you know, I tried to reach out to very specific individuals in the Silicon Valley or in America who had taken very wild bets in their life. Like, for example, the founder of Google, who have, you know, who are kind of known to fund projects without like a very specific business goal in mind, like the X Factory that Google runs. So he was sharing that, you know, I try to only raise funds from people who have done it themselves, because they understand the value of building such technology and who are kind of willing to, you know, not invest from a very traditional VC perspective, where a conventional VC, you know, expects a return in 5 to 7 years or maximum 10 years. But he mentioned that, you know, we were looking for VCs or funding from individuals who are okay to take 20, 30, 40 year bets and not like 5 to 7 year bets. And I did not think, like, you know, he shared, he did not think it was possible in the beginning. But then I started talking to people and kind of telling them, you know, this is what I really want to do. So there were a lot of no's for sure. But once he was able to kind of figure out, okay, I need to specifically look for people who get it, who are okay funding projects that have a 20, 30 year.
Yeah. Yeah. Smart guy.
Yeah. 20, 30 year return cycle and not a typical 5 to 7 year return cycle.
Smart guy. Yeah, I think this is like one of the growth hacks you should, you know, you should write on the, you know, somewhere on the internet and share, you know, in the startup world, because I think it's a nice hack, you know, in the terms of the growth hacking and how to find an investment. Yeah. So it, so for me, it proves that this guy is very smart.
Yeah. Do you feel if you guys are able to raise funding again, you'll give it a go again?
Yeah. So we've reached to the moment because, as I said, we were too optimistic. You know how hard running a software company is, and that if you are able to run one company well, it's already, you know, achievement. And, you know, running two different business lines is a really challenging stuff. So for many years we had put we didn't put much awareness and focus into this, you know, diabetes market and our product in general. We have one application that helps calculate nutrition values, but it's very much first of all it's in Polish only, because it's for the Polish users, at least we found, at least based on what we found, have this kind of therapy that involves counting in fats and proteins to your insulin dosage calculations when you are using a pump insulin. I'm trying to keep it simple. So we didn't put a lot of effort, because there was a couple of people working on that application part time, and mainly because those people are also having diabetes, so I'm appreciated of their efforts. And the point I'm trying to make is that the time was passing very fast, and we have been with the founders and management team, we have been so much focused on, you know, keeping the D-Labs AI running, and, you know, understanding how we should position ourselves, how to get the new customers, how to work around, you know, customer experience and keeping customers satisfied, that, you know, so many years have passed. We've gained so much experience how to run AI business successfully, that we forgot, and we have been still, you know, postponing, you know, this diabetes projects. And at some point I woke up one day and I figured out, okay, if I would, you know, die tomorrow, I would like at least to have a feeling that I did, you know, everything I could to try to bring the value to the people with diabetes by the good technology, because I still don't find these solutions I explained that we can see, you know, should be already here, helping people get their life better or be healthier in general. So we decided very recently that we need to strategically reconsider how we are running business, and diabetes and healthcare have to come to the, you know, again, our priority. So yes, in the next quarters we have a solid plan to restart the idea, probably with a different, you know, different value proposition for users. Maybe even, you know, with the different customer segments. Maybe it will be, you know, some sort of B2B platform or B2B product. We don't know yet at that time. But yes, thanks to the, because we are now a bigger company, so thanks to that we can also, I believe, restart this with more efforts also from the team. And yes, we are planning to get back to it and get some funding.
Can you guys not make like a physical device with the algorithm in it? That like a wearable device? Like that is not a possibility?
Yeah, it is. Actually, we have been thinking about that. We have been even trying to build something many, many years ago. At that moment, I don't know what it will be. I just know that that we need to restart, you know, the typical customer discovery, user discovery process to understand, you know, what, because many years have passed. So at this stage, maybe it will be advice. I think it doesn't matter at that moment. Because we need to start again thinking about, you know, what value we want to bring to what type of users and how the business model will work. Maybe it will be device, maybe it will be the platform. So many ideas are possible at that moment.
So I think I came across one or two companies. They started making stickers that you can stick on your body. And I am not sure what it calculates, but I think it calculates glucose. I'm not sure. It whenever you work out, it calculates, I think, pulses and a couple of more things from your body. And it gives you feedback as to, okay, how much workout, you like, what was your performance during the workout? So they started with stickers and now they are releasing rings. So you can just wear a ring. It has sensors on it, which takes data from your body and helps you figure out if you are performing good or not.
I think I've read about the company.
I believe I'm sharing this because your algorithm cannot be structured in a way that it can maybe go in such a device or a pack or something.
Yeah, it can, of course. Again, this is, you know, I think this is, you know, further on the path where it will be deployed, so to speak. Yeah. Because we have been thinking about that type of algorithm, you know, 7 years ago around. And I think, you know, we are in the different environment at the moment, meaning that there are many new devices and they are still coming, you know, the new ones. And we are not sure about what kind of strategy we'll take or if we'll implement this on this type of device or maybe we'll build our own device. This is still ahead of us because we don't want to, you know, stick to the old ideas because we believe that we should first understand, you know, how the world around changed during that time.
That makes sense. When you say diabetes, right, I have relatives who suffer from it and doctors are telling them not to eat, you know, desserts and cheesecakes, and they kind of hide behind us and eat the cheesecake with their friends, and they have to lie constantly because how not to have. So I'm sure, you know, you understand all of this better, but yeah, I would say diabetes is very hereditary also. Like if your parents had it, chances of you having it are very high.
Well, it depends, you know, it depends because you have, first of all, you have many types of diabetes, but let's say that the most common distinction is type 1 and type 2. So what you are saying, as far as I remember, might be true for type 2 diabetes. And for type 1, it doesn't necessarily needs to be true, meaning that I'm not an expert in, you know, in you know, genetics and all that things, but in my example, my parents didn't have, but my, as far as I know, some my grandparents or grandparent, yeah, had one, but what is it? Yeah, so I'm not I don't remember at that moment, you know, the exact how exactly that does it work. I know that at some point I was doing research on that, but my point is that in example, me and my sister have one, yeah, and my parents didn't have, and they don't have, yeah. And you know, that as far as I know, that it's not very common that two kids have and parents doesn't.
You know, I was talking to a gentleman named Emil. I was there last week, and Emil is the person who designed the Google Launchpad program. So all the incubation program by the brand name Google Launchpad. He was the man behind, like he was the brain behind the idea. And so he did that. He left doing that. And, you know, he was sharing his story on the podcast. And he shared that he does not do any of that anymore. But he is working on 2 to 3 companies right now, which are very much focused on female healthcare. So one of the companies is called UTI Free, because females suffer a lot from UTIs on a very regular basis. And the other company is focused on PCOS, because even that is a very common condition for females, PCOS, which is not widely discussed or even diagnosed, right? And I did not know this, but because he has been working in the healthcare space and research space for so long, he shared with me that the medical community, right, for so long have not been focusing a lot on testing symptoms and testing medicines for women. In the sense, most of the medicines are particularly designed only for men, to the point where if a female has a heart attack, a lot of times doctors simply are not able to figure out if it was a heart attack. Right.
Oh, and this is something I was not aware of. So very interesting.
I was not aware about it as well. So my mom works in the healthcare space, right? She works in the malaria department and polio department. She's a lab technician. So I asked her, right, is this true? Because this gentleman from Growth Mechanics, the company, is telling me that a lot of times females have heart attacks and doctors don't know if they had one. And my mom told me, yes, she has one colleague, and doctor basically told her that it's all in your head, nothing happened. And after a week, other doctor told her that, you know what, ma'am, you actually had a heart attack.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. That kind of blew my mind, because we live in 2022 and this should not be happening. So when you say you want to solve diabetes with AI, right? I don't know. My gut tells me that the research on this and the implementation of on this needs work. And the point you made that, you know, healthcare startups take a very long time to go from idea to test to the market. I don't understand why we are not able to do it even today, which is, I think, also what you are kind of thinking. Like, we are going to Mars, but we're not trying to solve these basic problems.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I could, you know, I could spend hours discussing this thing. I think this is one of my in December I'm planning to do some webinar about AI and the healthcare, and I'm doing a lot of research for that. And one of the things one of the conclusions I came into after doing a lot of research in that was the main the challenge is, and I see it also in my country, that the money, you know, the money are involved very much into the, you know, into the, you know, optimization of the system. What I'm thinking is that what we see now, at least in my country, and I think I see it in many countries based on the research, that money is one of the top factors, if something is, you know, if we should do some kind of treatment, etc., etc. And, you know, everything, every KPI is calculated based on the money, how much, etc. And for now, it's a gut feeling, or maybe it's a you know, human reaction to it. But I have a feeling that money should not be the you know, the main factor. Maybe.
Yeah.
That's probably, you know, I don't know personally how to solve that, but I think that this is the main challenge. You know, if the money is a factor, there will always be a, you know, somebody that will try to optimize on that.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that it shouldn't be that way.
Like, it drives a lot of behaviors.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can kind of lead to results which are not desirable.
Yeah, because, you know, it will be, you know, short-sighted, as an example. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, I think we are reaching, like, towards the end of our first episode. How was it for you? Is it something you were expecting? Like, what was your expectations, and how did it go?
Yeah, I think it was, on one hand, I was a bit nervous that, you know, maybe I will forget something, and it happened that I forgot some facts from my past. You know, when you're running a company, you have so many things, and you need to be involved in so many things that you are very often need to you know, spend time to recall some facts from the past. But in general, it was a nice conversation, and I think I like the fact that we have been, you know, discussing and talking over the cup of coffee, at least in my case. I think in general I would like to do it more.